to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly report bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Zachary Tharp.
I'm Isa Yu.
I'm Arman Rana.
And I'm Adeline Ping.
It is Thursday, December 12th at 5:06 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hinkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
We have a jam-packed show for you today. Two local politics interviews. The first is a conversation with Georgia Strait's Charlie Smith about structural racism in Vancouver's citywide electoral system and how it benefits the NPA. We also dug into the recent developments within the NPA. I then spoke to Alex Hemingway of the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives about how increased property taxes can be a good thing if it's used for public housing. But first, we'll have an ad break.
The world is a better place because of Kim Kardashian's empire,
Cheetos,
fleece material,
and Discorder.
It's a local independent music magazine from CITR.
Which means that we can print whatever we heckin' want.
Album and live show reviews, interviews with artists, and sweet illustrations grace our pages.
And even you, listener, can contribute.
Just visit citr.ca/discorder/contribute.
You can grab it around town or read it at discorder.ca.
Forever local and forever free.
Hey bro, I was kind of thinking that I might want to write like stuff for a magazine, dude.
You know you can do that at CITR and Discorder, right?
What?
Yeah, you can review live shows where you get in for free, or music and books and stuff that's coming out, or do write-ups on artists and local issues for Discorder magazine.
That's sick, bro.
Yeah, just email volunteer at citr.ca and they can help you get started or just come into the station whenever.
Dude, I totally will.
Welcome back. You're listening to Democracy Watch and CITR 101.9 FM. So City Councilor Rebecca Bly recently left the nonpartisan association, i.e. the NPA, because of a, quote, rightward shift in the party. The center-right party recently elected several people either perceived as being socially conservative, supporting Donald Trump, or having ties to federal or provincial conservatives to their leadership and board. I spoke to Charlie Smith of Georgia Strait about what is happening in the NPA, about the recent controversy surrounding the misidentification of the new NPA Secretary Ray Goldenchild, and how the NPA benefits from the current system, which disenfranchises people with non-anglicized names. So let's take a listen.
You're listening to Seeking Office. My name is Arman Rana.
Okay, so could you start off by introducing yourself and your role at the Georgia Strait?
My name's Charlie Smith. I'm editor of the Georgia Strait. I've been working at the Georgia Strait for 25 years, first as the news editor, and I'm a great admirer of university journalism.
That's great. I'm glad to hear that. So we've been following former nonpartisan association NPA councillor Rebecca Bly's decision to leave the NPA and become an independent. This was largely motivated by the NPA's new, quote unquote, socially conservative trajectory. Could you start out by briefly summarizing how the NPA is politically situated?
Traditionally, the NPA was a center-right party in Vancouver, but maybe with a little more emphasis on the center when it came to issues relating to social conservatism. In that, the NPA was the first party to have an openly gay councillor elected, which was Gordon Price back in 1986, and he served six terms on council. In the 1990s, there were lots of LGBT elected officials with the NPA, including Laura McDermott, Duncan Wilson, Alan Featherstone-Haugh on the park board, Alan Herbert on council, and other candidates. So this was a party that was seen to be LGBT friendly, and more centrist. You might want to characterize it as kind of federal liberal in a way, especially when you look at someone like Philip Owen, who was the mayor in the 1990s until 2002, that he brought forward some harm reduction measures. In recent years, the party has veered somewhat to the right. But what happened in the last election was most of the councillors who were elected, I would put more in the federal liberal camp than the conservative camp.
And so a recent article you wrote in The Strait calls for greater transparency in how the NPA selects its caucus members. Can you explain how this process works?
It's been actually quite atrocious for quite a few years. Back in the 1990s, they would hold nominating meetings, and there were raucous events with membership drives and all of these things, and I think it helped the party succeed. But what's happened in the past three elections has been the board choosing candidates for the most part in 2011 and entirely in 2014, including the mayoral candidate. And then in 2018, the board chose all the candidates except the mayoral candidate, which went to a nomination. But even then, the board vetoed two of the prospective candidates, including a sitting councillor. So the board has wielded tremendous power over the nomination process in the NPA in the past three elections.
So is this process different from how other civic parties operate in Vancouver?
Vision Vancouver was operating that way for many years, not as completely, but most of the nominations were being awarded in that way after the incumbents were elected in 2008. But at the same time, in the last election, Vision had quite an open process for nominations. COPE has always had very competitive nominations. Yes, Vancouver, which was a new party that emerged in 2018, it selected its candidates. So it's gone both ways, but the three kind of long-serving parties in Vancouver, which would be Vision, which started in about 2005, and COPE and the NPA, the NPA has been the outlier, I would say, in its nomination process.
I see. And so basically, when you say the board itself is elected by the members. It's just the board then selects, in the NPA, the board then selects the candidates or, in some cases, vetoes candidates from running if they do have an election.
Yeah, that's correct.
So Councillor Bly cites the election of new board members in the NPA, including the BC Conservative Party president, Ryan Warawa. And former Rebel Media BC Bureau Chief Christopher Wilson as an indication of the party's rightward shift. Now, the NPA has always been a center-right party, and as you mentioned, so can you explain why the election of these board members is causing so much concern?
Well, I think it's partly Ryan Warr was always being, a fairly hard right-winger in Vancouver. He's a known entity. But he is president of the BC Conservatives. His father is a long-time member of parliament in the Langley area, Mark Warawa. I think it's that this Stephen Harper's never been very popular in Vancouver. And so you get someone like Christopher Wilson, who's on the Conservative board, and Ryan Warawa, who are probably, I can't speak for Ryan as much, but with Christopher, is a Harper admirer. Christopher Wilson has been a Trump defender on Rebel Media. And I think Rebel Media itself is problematic because of the coverage that it gave Charlottesville, where many people on both sides of the border felt that Rebel Media was running content that was defending white supremacists. Christopher Wilson wasn't the person in question there, but he did defend Trump's response to Charlottesville. So you've got that aspect. On the socially conservative side, Phyllis Tang, who ran for Yes Vancouver, was endorsed by a group of social conservatives, as was another new board member, Ray Goldenchild, when he ran with Vancouver First. And Vancouver First was kind of a fringe party that was explicitly against the SOGI 123 program that's rolled out by the province to ensure that we have LGBT-friendly schools, including independent schools and school districts. With
so the SOGI, just for our listeners, SOGI stands for sexual orientation and gender identity.
Yeah. So that's one issue. The fact that a Vancouver First candidate and someone else who were each endorsed by a group that also endorsed almost notoriously anti-SOGI 123 candidates like Barry Neufeld in Chilliwack or Heather Leung in Burnaby, and Heather Leung was the one who was bounced from the conservative slate for homophobia. So I think this is a concern to someone like Rebecca Bly, who's in a same-sex relationship herself, and she just said, enough. I don't want to be part of this group anymore.
So just to go a bit back, there's these two new board members who have ties to the kind of the traditional Conservative Party, which is Christopher Wilson and Ryan Warawa. Yeah. I can never get that name right. And there's also these two candidates, actually part of the executive of the MPA, the new secretary, Ray Goldenchild, and treasurer, Phyllis Tang. And Ray Goldenchild, who is black, was actually misreported by The Straight and others to have appeared at an anti-SOGI event. But as you mentioned, both of them did previously run as candidates in parties that at various points in time put out socially conservative or anti-SOGI positions. So let's talk a little bit about that. So in his statement, Goldenchild pinned to his Twitter account, he included the following sentence. The context is necessary to point out Ms. Phyllis Tang and I are both visible minorities that have achieved high positions within the NPA. How diverse has the NPA been historically, especially in terms of supporting women and minorities? And how are they prioritizing that today?
That's a very good question. At the board level, they've had two previous presidents who have been minorities, at least two that I know of, Tung Chan and B.C. Lee. Tung Chan was an immigrant from Hong Kong. B.C. Lee was an immigrant from Taiwan. At the council level, I was disappointed in the lack of diversity in their council slate in the 2018 election. In the past, it's been mixed. I don't think it's been that great. In 2014, I thought there was a lack of diversity on the NPA slate. In 2018, they had a candidate of Chinese ancestry running for mayor, Ken Sim, but he didn't speak either Mandarin or Cantonese, which are the two main Chinese languages in Vancouver. And then none of the council candidates, they were all white, and they had opportunities to nominate people who spoke different languages. I think also when you're talking about, we're all a multiplicity of identities. And I think when you think about diversity with regard to the political process, it goes beyond just simply skin color. I think if somebody's an immigrant, they have one experience. If they're Canadian-born, they have another experience. I think having a capacity with languages is very valuable and should be made a priority in politics, because there are so many people.
But they haven't been made a priority, you're saying, in the NPA in recent history.
No. I think in the 1990s, they did a much better job, and even the late 1980s. The NPA was the first party to run candidates. The first Chinese-Canadian woman who was elected was an NPA candidate. There were people of Chinese ancestry, Bill Yi, before in the early 1980s, so Sandra Wilking wasn't the first. But through the Gordon Campbell years and Philip Owen years, they always had candidates of Chinese ancestry, and most of the time who could speak languages other than English. So you had Tung Chan, you had Daniel Lee, you had Don Lee. and also LGBT candidates, also candidates of South Asian ancestry, most of whom didn't get elected. One was elected to school board, but I attribute that to the racist electoral system.
Yeah, so talk a little bit about that, because you wrote another article, I believe, a while ago, talking about the structural issues in the voting system that prevents, in your view, minorities from getting elected at the city level.
Yeah, this is a very serious issue, and something that I think is more important than the, you know, whoever's on the NPA board at any given time. We have a structurally racist electoral system in Vancouver. It's called the at-large system, and candidates have to be elected citywide. It doesn't discriminate as much against candidates of Chinese ancestry because the Chinese community is large, and it's also dispersed. There's no neighborhood in Vancouver where you don't have more than 10% Chinese ancestry. I mean, less than 10%. But when it comes to Filipino community or South Asian community, these tend to be more concentrated minorities. And as a result, the electorate, for whatever reason, has tended to prefer candidates with anglicized names, and I think that's a big problem. And on a citywide basis, that has a tendency to discriminate against candidates who don't have anglicized names. So it's not a coincidence that the one candidate of color from the South Asian community who was elected in the last election was Jennifer Reddy to school board, because she has a name.
Jennifer.
Yeah, and Reddy, too, yeah. R-E-D-D-Y, although that's a common name in South India.
Yeah.
That isn't known to people in North America. So the U.S. Supreme Court and various other U.S. court decisions has ruled that these multi-member districts, this at-large system where a bunch of candidates are elected, discriminates against concentrated visible minorities. And we saw that, we've seen it repeatedly, particularly against candidates with South Asian names in Vancouver from 1990 to 2008. And then in 2008, Raj Handal was elected to the Park Board. But even he was elected with thousands of votes fewer than others on his slate. But because it was a Vision Vancouver landslide, he still got elected. In 2011, we saw a bit of a change in that Nikki Sharma was elected to Park Board and came in the middle of the pack, so she did very well, and it seemed like a breakthrough. But then in 2014, when she ran for council, she and Tony Tang were the only two people who lost on the slate, the two people with non-anglicized names. So I would like to see the council address this, but the council, which is 10 of the 11 members, including the mayor, White, have not made this an issue to date. And I'm very disappointed because Kennedy Stewart, the mayor, studied this in university. It was the subject of his graduate work.
How do you know that?
I know this because he was interviewed in The Straight in the mid-1990s on this subject, and I've interviewed him over the years on it.
Oh, I see.
So Kennedy Stewart...
That's very ironic.
...knows this. He told me to my face in an interview that to change the system, I have to run for mayor. And now he's mayor, and he still has three more years in office, so perhaps something will happen.
Yeah, but it sounds like it's a priority. I haven't heard anything other than you. Haven't heard any, you know, anybody else be talking about this issue.
No, he's investing his political capital in a SkyTrain system to UBC and rental housing in single-family zones. Some people... might think that this is a good use of his political capital, that rapid transit and more rental housing are wonderful. So I can understand why he's doing that, but at the same time, I'm deeply disappointed that he's not addressing the structural racism.
So is it possible that this kind of issue with elected candidates could also feed into or motivate people from minorities to seek higher positions within parties like the NPA? For example, both Phyllis Tang, she's of East Asian descent, while Ray Goldenchild himself was a former candidate who did not make it, I think it was for Park Board, I'm not mistaken. And that could be a motivating factor to get people into you know, trying to achieve at least a party position where possibly in an AGM where a small number of members turn out, you have a better chance of, you know, bringing your community out to support you?
Well, I think it's possible that they have run for their positions because they want to desegregate the NPA, and I think that's a laudable objective. And I think the challenge is, but at the in the elected system, first of all, though, I don't think either of them would be victimized by the non-anglicized name to the degree that many other Vancouverites would be.
Because the name Golden Child, Ray Golden Child, does not necessarily indicate your...
Yeah, I didn't even know he was of African ancestry until I saw his picture after I first noticed that he was endorsed by Social Conservatives, which caught my attention because over the years I've done a lot of reporting of candidates endorsed by Social Conservatives because I think our readers care about that. Phyllis Tang, I was aware of her as a Yes Vancouver candidate. She ran for council. And but at the same time, I didn't hear, I've never heard any of either of them or anyone for that matter in the NPA go beyond saying, well, let's just have a hybrid ward and at-large system. The NPA has never had, with the exception of the occasional candidate like Duncan Wilson who ran years ago for council, most of them have been very happy with the status quo.
Because it would favor their party because their support is kind of diffused into the, you know, Vancouver population. Or,
well, the other reason I think it would support their party is that big money benefits from the at-large system because you need a lot of money to get your name across the city. If you were only running in a concentrated constituency, like let's say you had a constituency of Point Grey or a constituency of Fraser View, then you could knock on enough doors and meet enough people and have a chance to turn an election. Or if you were locally known as a neighborhood activist or somebody who's involved in community issues, you'd have a good chance of getting elected. But when you're running citywide, it doesn't really matter as much what you've been doing in your neighborhood. You have to get your message across the city. Therefore, you have to join a slate, and therefore the slate has to have money. And the NPA tends to be supported by the wealthiest people in the city who are able to donate to the parties. And this is another problem at the municipal level, is there's no tax credits for people who donate to municipal political parties. So if you donate to the provincial or the federal party, you'll get something like 75 cents back on the dollar. But if you donate to a municipal party, you get nothing. So that almost creates a barrier for people who don't have means to donate to political parties, which again benefits the NPA.
I see. So last question. Given that the Strait was one of the sources that incorrectly identified another black man, Ron Haley, as Ray Goldenchild, what steps do you think the Strait can take in the future to ensure that such errors are not made?
I think the problem there has been blown out of proportion. I think it was a case of misidentification that the candidate or the director, Ray Goldenchild, said it was solely responsible for the concerns about social conservatism, when the reality is he ran with a party that was explicitly against the rollout of the SOGI 123 program. So the problem of misidentifying a person, like I had this discussion internally, that if we'd misidentified a white person in a caption, would that be seen as racism? I don't think it would be. I think racism is also something that a person has in their heart, which you never can really tell. You can just look at the actions. The actions is we misidentified somebody in a picture.
Yeah, but with respect, so I believe oftentimes people of color feel that they, especially if you're in a minority in general, you feel that you're more likely to be misidentified than another white person. So it there is of you wouldn't deny that there is a racial element to misidentification in general.
Well, I think there is, but that's assuming that we looked at this person and just said, oh, it's him. But the reality is that a person insisted, a source, that that was the case and that this was the person and guaranteed it. And that person was wrong. So if you look at what the lesson is don't take a single person's word in a situation like that ever again.
I see. Well, thanks so much, Charlie. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Okay, bye.
This interview was conducted on the unceded territories of the Hunkaminima-speaking Musqueam people by myself, Armand Rana, editing by Alex DeBoer, music by Blue Dot Sessions, song is Boston Landing.
You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9. You just heard an interview by Armand Rana, edited by Alex DeBoer, on the recent developments in the NPA.
I just want to add that I reached out to Ray Goldenchild, but he was not available for comment. What do you think of this issue of like misidentifying someone, or especially a person of color? Do you think it's a big issue?
I think it's not anything new. Like, I feel like this is something that has been going on for a long time. It's just, it is really focused on because, you know, I feel like it could, like, he had a point about how he felt like Ray Goldenchild was, like, blowing it out of proportion, which I don't agree with. I think it's very possible that, I don't think there was, like, conscious, like, malice in misidentifying Ray Goldenchild, but, like, it's just indicative of, like, what goes on and, like, what goes on in the media and who's really working in the media, and it shows, like, these biases. That's my opinion.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's unfortunate, you know, that this kind of still happens nowadays, mm-hmm. especially, you know, with the resources that news and, you know, media has, that you should be doing your, I don't want to say like facial background checks, but, you know, you should be, you know, verifying that who you're talking about is, you know, actually who you're talking about. Yeah. So
maybe it's about also a lack of resources in local news, that they need more resources and people are, you know, not checking people properly because they're just like running around at top speed and
Hire more fact checkers.
Do you think it's possible, and I might get in trouble for saying this, but do you think it's possible that they misidentified him because they were like, well, there's not that many black people like at this conference. Why are you signing? Okay. Why don't you like answer me?
I mean, like
do you think that's
sense,
possible, right?
I would hope that that's not the case.
Yeah.
Though.
Okay. Oh, I thought you were signing because of like what I was saying was stupid. No. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it could be. I don't know. It's also like, I think there's a photo with both of those gentlemen, Ron Haley and Ray Goldenchild, in the same photo together. Uh-huh. So maybe they're friends or something, and people saw that one picture of them and like misread the caption on one picture of them. I don't know. I don't know how that misidentification took place. But yeah, I think like one thing I was thinking about is like, if you know you have difficulty telling people apart from certain communities, I think you should probably like, just like get someone to double check and really verify properly.
Sure. Especially like, because it is a sensitive topic. Like you should like really put more effort into this.
Into those situations.
Yeah.
Like the thing is when you compare, like I think when you compare with other communities, like if it was like the dominant community, like white people, and you misidentify it, mm-hmm. It's not because you have difficulty, you know, like most people won't have difficulty telling them apart, but mm-hmm. I think it's because people are minorities, people can't tell them apart. And then mm-hmm. you know that, so you should go the extra mile in making sure you get it correct.
Yeah, and also you have to consider like history and like, yeah, that's all I have to say. Like you have to consider history and take that into account because we don't like live in this like post-race era.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. So to switch gears, Armand, you also spoke to Alex Hemingway of the Canadian Center of Policy Alternatives.
Yeah, I did. So City Council is currently debating an 8.3 property tax hike that was proposed by city staff. City councilors are scrambling to find cost savings to bring the number lower. I saw some people were making fun of Councillor Pete Fry for asking some questions about color printing or something, but I think he's just trying to find ways to...
He's trying his best.
Yeah, he's trying to find ways to cut costs. But Alex Hemingway had a different perspective, a policy alternative, you might say. And so his argument is quite interesting. It's predicated on the fact that we have the lowest property taxes in North America, which I didn't know, and that we're in the middle of a housing crisis. So let's take a listen to that if... Zach can pull it up.
If.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today. Could you start off by introducing yourself and talk a little bit about what the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives does?
Sure, yeah. So my name is Alex Hemingway. I'm an economist here at the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives BC office. We are a progressive think tank, and we do research on a whole range of public policy issues, everything from climate change and the fossil fuel industry to tax policy and public services, and of course housing, which is what we're going to talk about here today.
Yeah, so you wrote an article that appeared on policynote.ca and elsewhere entitled Property Tax in Vancouver Are Still Too Low, Fueling Inequality and Speculation.
Right.
This comes in light of a proposed tax hike of 8.3% by city staff. Could you make the case to our listeners as to why you believe the taxes are actually too low?
Yeah, so just, I mean, for a couple pieces of context, of course, we're in a housing crisis in this city, and that's a crisis of homelessness, and it's also a crisis of affordability for renters and so many people in the city. And you know, that's a complex problem, but one of the most important solutions to it is public investment in permanently affordable non-market housing. So I'm going to come back to that, but to talk about the property tax situation, the other piece of context I want to add is that Vancouver currently has the lowest property tax rate in not only Canada but North America, and that's because of kind of an oddity in the way that property tax is designed, and people might not be familiar with. So unlike an income tax where you have a sort of set schedule of rates and you pay a certain tax rate on certain levels of income, in the property tax system, we kind of work backwards. So the city of Vancouver in this case, will set its budget for the year, how much it needs to cover all the public services and other investments it plans to make. Then it'll look at the total value of property in the city, and it'll work backwards from there to come up with a rate that will get you the amount of dollars that are in the budget. So the consequence of that is that as property and in particular land values have just absolutely exploded in this city since the mid-2000s, hundreds of billions of dollars of increases in land wealth, we've actually continually lowered the property tax rate year after year to compensate for that. There are a couple of big problems with that, which we could get into, because it causes a spike in inequality, it encourages speculative investment in our housing system, and of course it deprives us of revenue that could be used to invest in affordable housing.
So we'll definitely get into that in a bit. So in the article, you assert that Vancouver actually has the lowest property taxes in North America. Could you describe how you measure that? It's just like the tax rate, or?
Yeah, so I talk about the property tax rate in the city, and that is the rate of taxation applied to the assessed value of a property. So, for example, you know, you can look at it in percentage terms or dollar terms, but probably the simplest way to talk about it is that the rate is $2.56 per $1,000 in assessed value. So it's a quarter of 1%. and that's the lowest rate in North America. Now, there
of any city in whole of North America, or
that's right. But that's not, you know, that's not the only. That's a crucial way of understanding what the property tax rate is, and I talk about why more in the piece, and we can get into it. There is another way of looking at it. You could say, well, what's the average property in the city in a given city, and you could compare what's the tax bill on that average property. Now, even on by that measure, we have low property tax rates. So, if you just to give an example, compare Vancouver to Toronto. In Toronto, the average assessed value of a property is about $665,000. Here, it's $1.26 million. So, it's a much higher value property here in Vancouver, but actually, even in dollar terms, the property tax bill is lower. That bill in Vancouver would be about $3,200 in property taxes, and in Toronto, about $4,100. So however you cut it, we do have unusually low property taxes.
And does that take into account like the provincial property taxes that are here in BC?
Yeah, that's all in. That's in the, both the municipal, provincial, and regional portions.
So another rationale I've heard for Vancouver having lower property tax rates is that while property values are up in Vancouver, incomes are comparatively low. So Vancouverites' ability to service higher property taxes might be lower than other American cities with similar property values. What is your response to that argument?
Well, certainly, you know, the direct mechanical cause of our low property tax rates is simply, as we talked about a little bit earlier, the city will set a budget, it'll look at property values, and it'll work backwards, yeah. And that's how we get at that low rate. So, you know, the related question is why have property values exploded in this way? That's a complex one, but certainly there's very high demand to live in the city. We've also seen, you know, issues around empty homes, which we're starting to rein in through the empty homes tax and speculation and vacancy tax. But a really sort of fundamental issue here is that, you know, when there is an economic boom and people's incomes increase, we don't suddenly cut the income tax rates. So that we hold those rates steady, and individual incomes go up. People benefit from that, and our collective revenues go up as well. So that.
But with respect, there is a difference. Sorry to interrupt you, but there is a difference, because even if you have property and you're living in it, and the value has gone up, your ability to service it hasn't changed. It's a function of your income, not necessarily of the value of the property that you live in, right?
Well, yeah, that's true, and you know, it does depend on the particular situation. So, you know, for example, I've been a secondary suite renter for most of my life, and the property that I lived in until quite recently, as a renter, increased in value by about $1.4 million. Pretty very ordinary, actually, kind of rundown single-family home in East Van. You know, we have, by the way, we've designed our property tax system, ensured that those bills aren't going up too quickly. If we did tax that wealth more substantially, as I'm proposing, there are issues, as you say, for being able to service those property tax rates. If someone is in a situation where they have that very high level of wealth but a lower level of income. A couple of ways to address that. When you have $1 million of increased equity, of course, people borrow against that all the time to make renovations and so on. And, you know, when you look at the actual increases we're talking about here, they're actually quite modest in dollar terms, and we could get into that and the comparison between the property tax increases and increases that renters face. But the other thing to keep in mind is that BC has a very generous program that allows property taxes for principal residences that you live in to be deferred until sale. You know, if you're over 55, if you're a family with children, and that includes if you have adult children in post-secondary, even if they don't live at home, if you're a surviving a spouse, your spouse has died, if you have disabilities, all of those people have access to that deferral program. And it is possible that we could extend that further if we were going to go down the road of beginning to tax this property wealth more seriously.
Yeah. So two things you mentioned there. So one thing was that you said you keep coming back to this point that we you know, set these rates in a very kind of backwards way. How do other cities make these kind of assessments and set these rates? And how would you recommend we do it? And the second point is, you said it will be good to get into the numbers of what these actual, because when you say 8% increase, people think that's a lot of money, but it's actually not that much money. So could you just give an example of how much that an increase in property tax will look like in real dollars
for
a typical home?
Yeah, and to be very clear, you know, this is typically how property taxes work, that working backwards process to get the rate. That's how property taxes are set in most Canadian cities. It's not true in some other cities around the world. It varies. You know, that's a system that may have worked well for a period of time. But the point that I'm making here is that when you get into a situation where property wealth is really exploding, we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars, that's when it becomes problematic, and we need to take a closer look at how that wealth is being distributed, because property is actually very unequally owned to begin with. We could come back to that if you'd like, but I'll move to the dollar amount issue. So, for example, that this 8.2% property tax increase, the median or typical condo in Vancouver is valued at $740,000. The property tax under this 8.2% increase would go up by $89 per year for that condo. If it's a detached house worth a lot more, it's going to be a bigger increase. So that typical detached house, $1.75 million, property tax is going to go up by $211, and there's also some utility fees that are going to go up additionally by another $143. So worst case, you know, for a typical, a very valuable detached house, you're talking about, in terms of that $1.75 million, about a $350 increase in that property tax. So that puts some concrete terms under it. And then, you know, I think it's useful to compare that to the situation of a renter. You know, if you're going to rent, a one-bedroom apartment and you're paying $1,800 a month, under the allowable rent increase, which is set by the province, your rent could go up next year by $561. If you're
That's annually.
Yeah, annually, yeah. Sorry, I should be very clear about that. So I'm trying to compare apples to apples in terms of annual increases. But and if you had a more expensive apartment, say you're a family, you've got a two-bedroom apartment, and it's costing you $2,600, your rent for the year could go up by $811. So it just to say, you know, that you know, it's really renters who are squeezed the most in this market, and we do need to think about you know, how we can address that.
Yeah, that's a good point. So basically, what you're saying is that the average renter in the current situation faces, irrespective of property tax increase, an increase of about $500 to $800, while in this, you know, somewhat unusual property tax increase, the a homeowner faces an increase of about $350 at worst case scenario.
And, you know, and the crucial difference between those scenarios is not only, you know, the difference in the increase being larger for renters, but of course the renters aren't benefiting from any of that land wealth gains that we've seen in the city. So, you know, that's not an offsetting factor that
they
may enjoy. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So speaking of renters, yesterday in council, NPA City Councilor Melissa DeGenova raised concerns about how higher property taxes could incentivize landlords to illegally evict tenants at a higher rate. Do you think this is a valid concern?
Well, I didn't see her comments or what the specific you know, mechanism she's saying by which that would happen. So it's a little bit tricky to comment there. I mean, what I can speak to is the idea that landlords will just pass on property tax increases to tenants, which is kind of a myth. But you know, we could get into that if you like.
Well, so yeah, why is that a myth?
Yeah, so the issue is when you're out on the rental market, the landlords are going to rent a unit for the highest that someone is willing to pay. All else equal, they may take other things into consideration, like you know, whether they get along with someone. But that's how market rents are set. You know, what's the highest someone's willing to pay for a unit? That doesn't change when your costs go up as a landlord. If you could will into existence someone willing to pay more for your unit, you would have already done that to begin with. So it's actually kind of it's a separate issue.
Yeah, yeah. So that makes sense, and that's why I was kind of interested in this dynamic about how it would incentivize landlords, because as you said, your costs are regardless of what your costs are, you always, as a landlord, want to get the highest possible rent you can get with a tenant who you get along with.
For the economists out there, you know, there is a more roundabout route that you could imagine that effect happening, a sort of supply-side route where you wouldn't have as many new units coming onto the market if you increase the tax rate. But that's actually a mistake, too, for some much more complicated reasons, although the simplest way of looking at it is that, you know, the biggest constraints on the supply of housing in the city are the fact that we reserve about 80% of the city's land exclusively for detached housing rather than for apartments. So, you know, if we're concerned about supply, keeping property tax rates keeping property tax rates low is not the best tool in our toolbox to increase the number of housing units we have in the city.
Yeah, that makes sense. So you make a case for the redistributive effects of, you know, increasing taxation, which intuitively makes sense. You know, land ownership is highly concentrated, and the land has increased in value a lot, so let's find a way to redistribute it. However, the current property tax hike is not directly linked to social assistance programs and redistributive measures, but also includes increases to police funding, for example. Is there a way you can assess how redistributive is the city spending here in Vancouver?
Yeah, well, you know, for example, you know, when I look at the what's proposed in the city budget, there's some of the increases allocated just to keep the lights on, to deal with inflationary costs, and also to make sure municipal workers are decently paid. Some of it's allocated to climate action initiatives, which is obviously crucial. We're in a crisis there as well. But then there's things like increased budget for the police, which I, you know, I think we could do without, although I can't claim to be an expert on the municipal police budget. I would want to focus, if we were going to tax property wealth even more aggressively, which is part of what we're suggesting here, I would want to focus a considerable amount of that investment on directly building affordable housing for not only folks who are homeless, but that first and foremost, most crucially, but also middle-class affordable housing. So, and of course, we have an opioid crisis in the city as well.
Yeah, yeah. So when you say directly building, what do you mean by that? Do you mean the city, you know, taking ownership of properties and, you know, hiring a builder to build it and owning the properties and renting them out, or?
That's right, yeah. Whether it's, you know, and you can have that done at the city level, you can have it done at the provincial level, and potentially at the federal level as well. And that one of the big advantages there is you can actually bring new rental units online at cheaper rents when you build it publicly for a couple of reasons. One is you can cut out that roughly 15% profit margin that privately financed development is typically building in. And the government has the ability to borrow at much lower rates than the private sector, which can bring in some considerable cost savings as well. So, you know, one of the things when we talk about public investment in affordable housing that sometimes gets overlooked is just the simple fact that it's not only a cost, it's not only an upfront cost, but it creates a new revenue stream in rental income for the public sector over time. So to a considerable extent, it pays for itself, but to get the levels of affordability you're going to want, that's where you're going to need to inject some additional public funding.
And are there examples of this you can point to?
Oh, sure. I mean, we have a significant non-market housing ecosystem in the city and region. It's not large enough, but you have a mix of housing run by nonprofits, housing arranged as a co-op situation, cooperatively run housing, often on land leased from from the city. And then you have housing that's run directly by the provincial housing agency, BC Housing. So we do have this type of housing. The question is of expanding it. And investment in that non-market housing really fell off a cliff in Canada and in BC starting in the early 90s and has just very recently started to tick back up again. But we have this huge backlog of need from a couple of decades where we badly underinvested in that area.
So to be clear, that's the example of the provincial government doing this, not necessarily the city.
Yeah, and you know, so you see the city partner in different ways. They do have examples of this. So for the apartments for folks who know this area, above the Mount Pleasant Community Center, that's a city-owned building, city-owned rental, and then you see the city partner with other levels of governments often putting up land. And I'm not sure off the top of my head how many examples of directly city-run rental housing there are. It's not crucial that this be done at the municipal level. As we sort of alluded to before, the province controls aspects of the property tax as well, and that could be used at that level of government. My main point is that these different levels of governments do have tools at their disposal, and given that we're in a crisis, they should use them.
And so lastly, and also you alluded to this earlier in our conversation, and you also mentioned in the article that low property taxes fuel speculation. Could you explain that dynamic?
Yeah, so when you think of someone looking to invest, whether it's someone domestically or from around the world or right here in the city, investments typically come with a carrying cost. So just for example, if you were going to invest in mutual funds, that comes with fees, often very high fees, until recently close to 1% in many cases. So that's the carrying cost of that investment, and that's coming out of the returns you get. And property taxes are part of the carrying cost of real estate in Vancouver. So when we have a property tax rate of 0.25%, that means those carrying costs are very low, much lower than they used to be and much lower than other jurisdictions, which makes holding real estate in the city particularly attractive relative to other investments, certainly compared to what it would be if we had a higher property tax rate.
All right, that makes sense. So is there anything else you'd like to add before you wrap up?
No, I think we've covered a lot of ground here. Better leave it there.
Thanks so much for your time today, Alex. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for inviting me.
Yeah.
So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. You just heard an interview that I conducted with Alex Hemingway off the Canadian Center of Policy Alternatives. We cut it short a bit, and we'll probably possibly be uploading the full interview at some point on various platforms. And before we go today, we have some local headlines.
Right. So on Tuesday morning, Harbor Air Seaplanes, our local seaplane airline here in Vancouver, completed a test flight with the world's first commercial e-plane. The CEO of the company, Greg McDougall, took off in a modified version of the company's Havilland Beaver aircraft and flew over the Fraser River in Richmond. He described the experience as similar to flying the original plane, but that flying current version was like flying a beaver on steroids. Right. So what's interesting about this plane is that it would be completely operating on batteries, and I think they were lithium batteries. And so that will lower the operating costs and theoretically would lower the price of the tickets, which like for consumers is a good thing. It can also fly for 160 kilometers before needing to recharge in its current state. But yeah, so
How far is that? Like, how far could you go on 160 kilometers?
Like Vancouver Island, maybe.
Yeah, I think Vancouver to Nanaimo and back without having to refuel or recharge.
So right now they do, like a barrier they have is the weight of an airplane, because compared to a car, it's more easy to have like an electric car compared to an airplane because it's heavy and the batteries aren't used to operating at that level. But yeah, so in light of a recent spotlight on climate, what are your thoughts on this major development?
So usually when we think of flying, we think of how we're consuming like a lot of fuel compared to our other methods. So it would be interesting to take a deeper look at how our perspectives change when we think of ourselves using this new greener alternative to the traditional fuel-based methods. So just to get your guys' thoughts, if you were to try flying in an electric plane today, how do you predict you would feel?
Well, the thing is, because this is a very new development, and as I've mentioned before about like the weight being an issue, like I would be personally concerned about safety. Like I would personally probably feel more safe on a traditional fuel-based airline. I don't know about y'all. Thoughts?
I don't know. I've flown from Vancouver to Castlegar through the mountains, and that plane's just shooting around. So, you know, I'm kind of used to feeling, you know, in a kind of crazy plane, but for the price alone, I feel like that would definitely be worth it. It's like, oh, yeah, my ticket's half of what it would cost to go to the same place and the same route, but now I'm actually, you know, helping the environment at least a little bit. So, yeah, I would definitely say it would be worth it. Plus, nowadays with, you know, other renewable energy sources like solar and wind and everything, you could have a completely carbon neutral plane, you know, flight, and that would make your vacation feel even better.
Yeah, that would be really ideal. But since this is like being developed as we're speaking, would you not be concerned at all about safety?
I like being a test dummy.
Armand has something to say.
Yeah, I don't think I would. Like, I think the one thing I remember when people with electric cars, when they first started rolling out, people got really spooked by how silent they were. Mm-hmm. And I get, because you don't hear the sound of the, like the fuel being burned and stuff like that. So I guess that might also be an issue with the plane. It's just like you're flying
and
flying in the sky. You can just hear birds next to you just like squawking around. so that would be interesting. So that might be scary, a scary aspect to it. But I wouldn't be scared about the safety aspect of it, I don't think. And yeah, I think we're out of time, so.
Yeah.
Okay, well, you know, that brings us to the end of the show. Thank you for listening. Tune in next week for more Undercovered Current Affairs. I just recorded an interview, actually, for next week's show with Extinction Rebellion and on their proposed hunger strike. So, you know, we'll see how that goes. So tune in and, you know, for more CITR programming.